Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Sending your kids off for the day to nursery or school can often mean packed lunches need preparing, and finding the time to put together a nutritious meal can sometimes be tricky. So, from a name that you can trust, make sure to try the Little Yo pouches from Yo Valley. Not only are these 90 gram pouches a perfect lunchbox size, but they're easy to eat and recyclable. A good source of protein and calcium, these Little Yo pouches are perfect fuel for busy days and packed full of live cultures that will help support healthy and happy tummies. Available in two delicious flavours which come in the recyclable pouches, these Little Yo yogurts are perfect for snacking on the go. To find out more, head to yovalley.co.uk and find it in your local supermarket. Hello, and thank you so much for tuning in to this week's Food for Thought, a podcast that's on a mission to equip you with all the evidence-based advice that you need to live and breathe a healthy lifestyle. I'm Rhianna Lambert, registered nutritionist, best-selling author of Renourish, A Simple Way to Eat Well, and founder of Retrition, London's leading private nutrition clinic. In each episode, I'll be joined by special guests, all of whom can be considered authoritative voices in health, so that together we can learn fact from fiction and empower the healthiest and happiest versions of ourselves with trusted expert advice. Anyone will tell you that hunger is just one of so many reasons that we eat, and those with a tendency of emotional eating are especially vulnerable to making poor dietary choices. If you're an emotional eater, you may find yourself eating to deal with uncomfortable emotions, using food as a reward perhaps when you're happy, and craving sweets or unhealthy snacks when we're stressed. And please do not worry if this is you, because you are not alone. This week's Food for Thought sees psychiatrist Dr. Chichi Oboya and I unearth how we can gain back control of eating and understand how to stop the vicious cycle of guilt, shame, and restriction. Hello, Chichi.
Hello, Rhiannon. Good to speak to you again. It's been a while.
It has. But do you know, I remember we were on a panel event before, and you've always stuck with me because you were such a great speaker, and I thought of you instantly when this topic came up. So thank you for your valuable time.
No problem at all. It's very kind of you.
Let's start by addressing the real first step, I guess, in addressing emotional eating. What would you suggest to everybody listening? What can they do?
I think it's really interesting time to be talking about emotional eating. It's been an interesting 6 months since we tried to first set this up, and maybe it's been good timing that we are speaking now, because 2020 has been a really tough year for a lot of people. And I think emotional eating is one of the things that people can identify with. Maybe if we'd spoken earlier, it might have been a topic that didn't really resonate with everyone. But people are feeling challenged. Stress is a major issue that is wearing many different faces. And so emotional eating is one of the responses that people are exhibiting alongside poor sleep, increased alcohol intake, lots of ruminative thinking. So I think it's a really important topic to address. And just to think about how it affects people and some of the strategies people can adopt not to fall into the common traps.
Yeah, no, completely. I think you're right. I think, I mean, 2020, it's going to be a year I don't think anyone will forget. It's impacted so many people, as you said, on multiple levels, from the emotional food side to relationships to workplace environments, everything. But you mentioned something that struck a chord on me then, and that was stress. Do you think that's one of the biggest causes of emotional eating, maybe before the pandemic and now?
I do, but I think it's important to unpack that a little bit, because stress is one of those terms that is used very widely and means different things to different people. We can think about stress as both a short-term and long-term phenomenon. So things may happen on a given day that cause us to feel anxious, frustrated, disappointed. But stress, broadly defined, is also thinking about adversity that people may have experienced, for example, during their childhood or adolescence. So that's one dimension. The other dimension is that when we talk about the link between then the stress and the emotional eating, that might be something that is very conscious. So an example would be, I've had a rubbish day, I deserve to treat myself to some chocolates, versus an unconscious process. So if someone has maybe had really significant childhood adversity, they may, for example, have concerns about their body image, and the emotional eating is a response to feeling a sense of shame about their body image, but the person may not fully understand that link. So it can run along different dimensions. And I think the lockdown period during the pandemic has also brought some other characteristics out. So we know that everyone's baseline stress levels have gone up, but there are some other factors. We're confined to our homes a lot more than we ordinarily would. Some people are working from home, so they're pretty much spending most of their working hours at home. And the elephant in the room is that we're in closer proximity to our fridges. And therefore, there's a real need to acknowledge that the ingredients for emotional eating are there, probably more so than they ever have been.
I like how you describe that, the ingredients. Almost good pun there, I guess, play on words. But on a serious note, of course, I mean, I've been feeling it, cabin fever. It feels like we just don't go anywhere anymore. And you're right, the fridge. There was a study that I remember looking at university which dictated that if you could see food actively, you're more likely to go and eat it than if even the cupboard doors were shut in the kitchen, and when they were left open. It was so fascinating. I guess that applies here, doesn't it? With it being in the environment you're not used to.
Yeah, that's a great observation. One of the books that I think is quite impactful as a recommendation when we're thinking about getting into healthy habits, and healthy eating is a habit I'm sure a lot of people aspire towards, is a book called Atomic Habits by James Clear. And he stresses the importance of making the development and sustenance of those goals easy and achievable and attractive. So on the one hand, if we're trying to adopt healthy eating habits, those are some of the characteristics. If we're trying to lose some less desirable habits, you need to do the opposite. So you need to make it unattractive and very difficult to do. So I think some of those principles could be applied to what we're doing around our food. So if there's a tendency to engage in unhealthy eating, what are the measures that we could take as individuals to make it that bit harder? So a good example would be, if actually accessing the food becomes harder, you've got to make more of an effort to get hold of it. If you put it in, dare I say, an ugly looking tin, it's less desirable than something that is beautifully laid out. Let's say having your fruit in a beautiful fruit bowl, that makes it more attractive. And therefore, when we have that sort of instinct kicking in and we're not really thinking what we're doing, we want to be in a position where the things that we're reaching for are more attractive, more desirable, and it's harder for us to get at those things that we're trying to avoid.
That's fascinating. It's an angle that I don't think I'd actually, obviously it's not my line of work, and you're a psychiatrist, it's obviously what you do for a living, but you must speak to so many people that are really struggling to navigate this time, I guess, because there's almost a message online in social media realms that states, don't feel guilty, you know, eat what you want, it's fine, you know, that kind of response. But if it's not making people happy, eating emotionally, then it's not okay, is it? I think we have to embrace those tools that you just said, as in, let's try and make things less desirable sometimes, because that's equally okay. I think people sometimes feel shame and they feel a lot of guilt for their behaviors. And I mean, how would you recommend someone minimize the type of stress then involved with emotional eating? So one thing they can do is help with the environment. Is there a way they can try and get the stress down?
Well, I think one of the important points to make first is that there isn't one narrative that's going to be relevant for everybody. Mm. There's a danger that we tend to focus on overeating. There are big public health campaigns around obesity. There's a big government push to think about things like food labels. That can sometimes be counterintuitive because it makes people feel bad about what they're doing. And as you said, sometimes it's good that people can treat themselves, and we need a bit of balance. Mm-hmm. But also it's important to recognize that there are a group of people that undereat, and those messages can be quite hard for them to make sense of, because it's going against some of the work that they're doing to manage their relationship with food better.
Yeah.
So I think
the public health dilemma, right? How to get one message for all.
So I've talked about difficult relationships with food in the context of the pandemic, but I think it is important to stress that the eating is sometimes the symptom and it's not the underlying issue. So if we're saying that people are under increasing levels of stress, it's important to fully understand, number one, what's driving the stress. And sometimes that's just a sense that people feel that things are out of their control, or they underestimate their ability to overcome challenges. And that in itself is not helped by the fact that we are being forced to isolate ourselves from our natural support networks. So we can go from just looking at overeating, and actually that's the tip of the iceberg, but the real problem might be in social connections. So what are the things that people can do to maintain a sense of connection with friends and family, for example?
I think with our relationships with loved ones, I mean, it's totally affected at the moment. When you mentioned the iceberg, then I could see an image that I remember reading somewhere where you can see the water and you can see the tip of the iceberg emerging from the water. And underneath the water, you can see all those tiers of things like your friends, your workplace, the stress, all the things that create that iceberg, essentially, which is a really good diagram for anybody that wants to kind of do it at home themselves and think what's actually going on in their lives at that moment. Because I think relationships perhaps are one of the biggest drives, aren't they, to developing emotional eating sometimes.
They can be. I'd say top of the list would probably be relationships with family members. And again, contextualizing that, so thinking about the whole range of disordered eating, that can be a trigger because of historical factors going back many, many years, and things which have happened in the past, or sensitive words that have been uttered and remembered. And so for people who maybe have moved out of home, but have been forced to go back and live with their parents at this time, that can be really difficult for them. mealtimes can be tricky for a lot of people, and therefore if one is used to eating a meal in isolation and having a sense of control, it can be quite hard if you're then forced to sit with the family at a set time, which isn't the time of your choosing, and you're eating in front of people, which again is difficult for some, and there's just more scope for people to be commenting on how long it takes you to eat a meal or why you didn't eat certain foods. And one of the things that's very well established in the psychiatric literature is a concept of high expressed emotion. And that covers a number of themes, including the perception of over-involvement by one's loved ones, critical comments, and generally what we would refer to as micromanagement. And those can have a negative long-term impact on somebody's ability to overcome certain eating disorders like anorexia nervosa. It's also implicated in a number of different mental health conditions. And so I think we shouldn't underestimate the impact of challenging family dynamics on an area that may already be quite tricky for people to navigate.
Yeah, no, completely. You've explained that perfectly, actually. And I'm sure a lot of people listening will be very grateful for the fact that you've brought that up. I think moving back with parents, if we pick on that as one area, just to go into a little bit, obviously I'm now a new mum. And I'm very
aware.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I hear that you also have congratulations to be in order as well. So we're both navigating
this
parenthood realm, and it's hard, isn't it? And I think I'm sure you must feel the same, Chichi, in that you'll know to be very conscious not to comment on shape or appearance and weight and try and create positive language. But it's not really something people are told to do, is it? So it's no wonder that different generations have created issues around food, really.
No, and I think sometimes we just have to hold our hands up and realize that we haven't said the right things and that there's opportunity for better learning. I think for people who are struggling with their food, we have to be realistic about the circumstances at the moment. There may not be the easy option of isolating oneself, and family members are there. But there are some things people can do, and I would encourage them to think about whether there's anyone outside of their family, if they're finding that family members are triggering, somebody outside their family that they can be accountable towards. And if necessary, there are a range of eating disorder charities like BEAT and Overeaters Anonymous that can provide some counselling, signposting to a range of resources and other forms of help. So I'd really just emphasise that people shouldn't feel as though there are no options. There are some things that they can get some help with, but also some things they can get a sense of control over, like planning their meals and maybe keeping a food diary that might sit alongside a mood diary. And what can happen at that stage then is that it's possible to generate some data that's going to outline what sort of patterns there are and what are the things that actually trigger people to become or to get into difficulty with their food, rather.
Yeah, I mean, keeping a food and mood diary, I think, is a pretty good tip for people that maybe don't have access right now to support, because I'm sure that the services are completely stretched, and I'm sure you're extremely busy at the moment. I know we've been so busy from a nutritional perspective in the Retrition Clinic at the moment. And that's something that people can do at home, isn't it, to identify any patterns. What should they do, though, if they start keeping a diary at home and they're noticing that they're really not feeling their best and there's something that's a red flag there? Is there any online resource they can turn to for anybody listening right now that you'd recommend?
I think before we even get to online resources, let's think about what the the value of planning these things and of tracking one's food would be, what we're really talking about is that ability to understand what the main triggers are. Because like a lot of things in my world, just developing insight into what's really driving the difficulty is the starting point. There's an acronym I can share with you for some of the potential triggers. So we've talked about the fact that we're close to our fridges. What are the things that drive people to, for example, comfort eat? So the acronym is BLAST, and the B stands for being bored. And I'm sure that's something we can all identify with. At the moment, there are just times where we don't have access to the range of leisure activities, being able to go where we would like. And sometimes our eating habits are just driven by pure boredom. Remember that each of these things could lead to what we might view as a negative response, but the idea is that you need to generate an alternative solution. The L stands for being lonely. Isolation, we know, can have a huge impact on people's mental health. And it's a big challenge at the moment. So particularly people who might live alone, people who might live alone and are working from home, that's really tough because they're just not getting the level of social engagement that they would like. The A stands for being angry. And I think there's plenty of anger going around in society for a whole variety of reasons. And we've talked about stress. So the S is for stress. Another important one, T, for being tired. So that's not an exhaustive list, but it just outlines a few pointers for the sorts of things that might be driving this sort of behavior, but it gives the opportunity for a different response as well.
No, thank you. That's extremely, extremely helpful. Do you find, I'm sure a lot of people would want to know, that there are certain trigger foods that people tend to reach for? And do you think that they're the sorts of foods that people should be maybe limiting in the house? Obviously, it's very difficult on an episode like this because everybody's going to have a different relationship with food, a different case. And as you said, people undereat, they overeat, they don't think about food enough, or they think about food too much. But in general, are there certain food groups that you find perhaps cause more problems than others?
Certainly in my clinical experience, we are talking predominantly about sugary foods. And the reason I say that is that those are the sorts of foods that are going to get your blood sugar up. So if you are feeling really hungry, these are the foods that will give you a bit of a rush and satisfy your hunger quicker than anything else. We also need to think alongside that about the dopamine pathway. So that's the reward system in the brain. I want to emphasize I'm not here to be a killjoy. But if you take your favorite snack, for example, you probably feel good. So it might be having some nice chocolates. It does feel good. And there's that sense of anticipation. So the dopamine pathway is in action at that stage. And the danger becomes if you have the opportunity to go back, and then go back again and go back again, that can become a habit. So there's nothing wrong with enjoying a particular type of food, but it's about having things in reasonable proportions.
Yeah, you mentioned habit rather than addiction. And I think that's something that can be very confusing for people to differentiate between, because you hear the phrase a lot being thrown around, I'm addicted to sugar, therefore I must cut it out completely. But the response that I would obviously say is, you know, if you have it in moderation, you're less likely to probably want to overeat on it. But do you hear that a lot in your line of work, the confusion between sugar perhaps and addiction?
I think so. And we're trying to cover a whole range of individuals and behaviors. So again, stressing it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, and that we're talking about a spectrum of relationships with food. So I think the key thing is for people to understand where they are. Some people will be more driven by data. So the whole concept of a food diary is the sort of thing they'd be interested in doing. Whereas for others, they want to do things just a little bit more intuitively. And that just sounds like a really boring exercise to actually spend time writing down what you're eating. So I think it's just about having a broad sense of where you are, being adequately educated, and then deciding what you're going to do with that information, rather than trying to dictate exactly what people should do. So in relation to types of food, I'd want to keep things quite simple. I'm not a nutritionist, I'm a psychiatrist, but I think the concept of having a balanced diet and not becoming too preoccupied with eliminating certain foods or focusing on certain food types. If you're an elite athlete, that might be a bit different. But beyond that, for your average Joe, it's just about having things in proportion and being better informed.
Yeah, exactly. We are all unique, and it's having everything in moderation. And thank you. I actually quite liked how you said, you know, I'm not a nutritionist, because I'm most definitely not a psychiatrist. And I think a lot of people out there will perhaps see somebody quite influential in the media or in the spotlight pedal pushing a one size fits all approach. And again, even some public health messages, of course, they have a place, of course they do, but it doesn't mean it applies to everyone as a gospel, you know, as a set rule. And you mentioned intuitive eating. So for some people, you mentioned quite rightly, some people do thrive off having more of a structured approach, but other people do like to say goodbye to those rules. And it can be quite a helpful approach, I think, for quite a few people when they're working on their relationship with food. Let's discuss, and it's again very difficult to navigate such a sensitive conversation that we have to keep saying, of course, everybody out there, we hope this is helpful and not going to alienate, because we know you've all got something different going on right now. Everybody does. Let's bring up the topic of obesity a little bit, because we know that at the moment in the pandemic, the government have brought this up quite a few times, and I'm sure that has also equated to some anxiety for a lot of people. How much of a correlation perhaps have you seen recently, Chi-Chi, with emotional eating and obesity?
Yeah, that's a
big question.
Topic.
Sorry. Yes.
It is. No, I think it's absolutely fine to ask about that. I'm going to answer that in what might seem like a roundabout way, but I just want to highlight one thing. So I think in society there's a danger that we jump to conclusions, and within this topic of obesity and the public health messaging, I think we're at risk of falling into the trap of one narrative, which is a valid narrative, but it doesn't cover everybody. And it's basically the idea that everything is down to the individual, and it's just about them having better discipline. And if people could just be more disciplined, they would eat healthier and they wouldn't be obese. So speaking from a psychiatric perspective, there's been a reasonable amount of research looking at what we call adverse childhood experiences. Remember at the top, we talked about stress broadly defined, and how we're talking about adversity that may have occurred at any point across our lifespan. So what I am talking about is quite significant forms of trauma that people may have experienced during their childhood. And that's been shown to have longer term effects. So something may have happened in somebody's childhood, but as an adult, they may, for example, present as overweight. And just filling in the gaps there, if we talk about someone who's been severely abused, for example, they may have a sense of shame about their body. And on an unconscious level, one of the ways to protect themselves from any further harm is to overeat, to make themselves both feel less attractive and to appear less attractive to other people. So this whole issue of fat shaming, where somebody just makes a judgment based on someone's appearance, may completely miss a whole range of difficulties that person has experienced earlier in their life. So I can just really emphasize the need for us to show a degree of sensitivity, yeah, thought, and not to jump to conclusions.
Yeah, being kind. I think in society, we're too quick to judge a book by its cover. Everybody has a story and a pathway, don't they, to get to where they are and the reason they are the way they are. And as you quite rightly said, fat shaming is just not okay, and it's not going to solve anything. That it's a very, well, I'm sure maybe some people may react to it, but the majority of people I work with most definitely do not react positively to that sort of behavior. I don't condone it at all. It's very sad, actually. I think we've even got to a space at the moment where this sort of thing happens. I think food advertising is all around us as well, and it's very difficult to avoid it. I mean, everywhere you turn, if you're walking down the street, there's a billboard with food, or on the TV adverts, it's always food. Do you tend to find that that's also a bit of a hindrance for people in terms of working on their relationships with food?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the point I was trying to make, which is that might be applicable even, let's call it, the majority of people. But for those that it doesn't fit, it can be really painful because it's reinforcing the sort of negative self-talk they're already engaging in. Mm. And those are the people that you're going to miss out on in terms of actually effecting real change, because it reinforces those negative thoughts and it makes it harder for them to, if you like, grant themselves permission to seek help. So it's a tough job that the government have, mm, because I think there is more that people could do, and there are situations where people do need to take responsibility for their choices. But then you open up this can of worms, because there are really broad issues even around areas like poverty and the fact that people make food choices based on their financial means. Yeah. So it's all very well talking about, you know, we could tell everyone that they should be eating sweet potato and quinoa, but if they can't afford it, exactly, it's not going to be something that they're going to be able to do. Mm. So yeah, it just needs to be approached with real sensitivity.
I completely agree. I wish, and this is a bit of a dream kind of scenario, but I wish that everybody had access to a psychiatrist or psychologist like yourself, a nutrition professional and a doctor and a PT. And we had this lovely balanced individual approach to every single person's life. But as you said, there's so much disparity in the UK with income, financial reasons, education, cultural, ethnicity. There's so many factors to take into account when we're thinking about a human being and how they see the world, and as a result, how things happen and how we react to situations. I mean, in terms of thought-provoking activities that somebody could do, what are your thoughts on meditation as being something that someone can try and do at home?
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
It's a great question. It goes back to the theme of what is the issue that we're trying to deal with? And let's not just deal with the behavior, which in this case would be emotional eating. But if the problem is that somebody's stressed, then absolutely we should look very broadly at things that are going to help them to manage their anxiety. So I really like this concept because we are talking about a phenomenon that can affect all people. I love this concept of a sort of continuum of anxiety. Anxiety is a normal phenomenon, but it will affect some people more than others. And in some cases, it will lead to a more pronounced manifestation. But there are certain markers that you might look for, and a poor relationship with food is just one of a number of things. It might be that people are consuming too much media because they're worried about what's going on in the world. They may be drinking too much alcohol. They may be engaged in ruminative thinking. And so the approach that you're going to take there isn't just going to be about food. It's going to be, well, how can we manage your stress better? So absolutely things like yoga and mindfulness meditation are going to be part of a package of things that you'd want to be able to offer people. And this isn't sort of fluffy pseudoscience, because what yoga would do, for example, is that it actually corrects an imbalance between the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And the sympathetic nervous system in particular is responsible for our fight, flight, or freeze response. So that's when we acknowledge that there's a sense of danger, and that's the system that promotes the secretion of adrenaline in response to something that causes us fear. So yoga activates the parasympathetic nervous system that helps us to rest and digest our food. And so it actually has a scientific basis behind it. So although it may not seem like something that's going to be directly related to emotional eating, I think these things all overlap, and these are relevant tools that might just give you some marginal gains, and in aggregate, things start to shift in the right direction.
I'm really glad you mentioned movement actually as well, because this isn't just pseudoscience or some hyped up hippie thing. It's genuinely the fact that it has been shown that if you move, you do feel better, and surely feeling better will reduce the likelihood of any coping strategy that's needed, maybe a little bit. So there's no harm in encouraging people to try and move a bit more. And again, on the flip side, I just want to cover myself what I've just said by, I know that over-exercising is also a concern for a lot of people in the current situation we're in as well, and in general it was before. And you have to find that balance of movement, don't you, Chi-Chi, that definitely works for you.
Absolutely. It feels like with every theme we're covering, there's a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
So yes, movement is something that's helpful, and exercise. The way I would look at it is that it's one of the things that helps to give us a sense of routine. And it's our routine that has been disrupted as much as anything, and that's going to mean different things to different people. But we are mainly creatures of habit, and we're having to make adaptations to our routine. But I think for most people, they do need to have some sense of routine in order to function towards the optimal end. So exercise is a good one for relieving stress. It can be linked to our eating as well, because if we are thinking about trying to manage our weight, just getting the timing of exercise can really help. It doesn't necessarily need to lead to overeating. And it's another good way of activating that reward system and get the endorphins flowing.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like the routine, like you said. I mean, I've been noticing anecdotally for myself that it's much harder to be to motivate yourself when you don't have the routine. And I'm sure that it also acts as a distraction from the new living environment and world that we live in right now. But Titi, that does move me on to a part of the podcast, which may be a little bit tricky for this topic, but we'll give it a go. And it's a fact or fiction round. So, are you ready for this?
What if my answer's no?
You've got no choice, I'm afraid, because you said yes to the podcast.
Okay. Am I going to be marked on this?
No, I think
I'll have to have final editing rights. But yes, let's go for it.
It's impossible for us health professionals to so much nuance, but let's give it a go. Here we go. Stress is the biggest cause of emotional eating. Fact or fiction?
Is there a right answer? You've got me nervous now.
Not at all. Just your opinion. You can expand on any of the answers. Please don't worry.
I'm going to be a really awkward interviewee. I would say that it's one of a number of factors, but yes, I would lean towards saying that it's the biggest factor when we look at it in a very broad sense.
Yeah, there we go. Emotional eaters are typically overweight.
That's a hard question. How do I answer that? I would say that's fiction. We've talked about the fact that there's a range of disordered eating, and I really want to get away from the focus on obesity and overeating. Yeah, so I would say false.
Yeah, I like that. There is a difference between physical hunger and emotional hunger.
That would be a fact. So I've touched briefly and very crudely on some of the neuroscience. There are hormones in our brain that tell us when we've reached the point of satiety. That's when we feel full up. And there can be disruptions. And also when we're hungry. So there can be disruptions in those hormones that mean that people don't stop eating through no fault of their own, and then there's going to be a tendency for people to put on weight.
Well explained. Definitely. Emotional eating only affects women.
Fiction.
Yay, straightforward one.
But just to expand on that, the reason that statement probably comes about is that when we do look at some of the established eating disorders, in particular anorexia nervosa, the rates are significantly higher for women more than men. We don't fully understand the reasons for that. And we do feel that eating disorders in men probably have a slightly different character. There's a bit more around, or there's a difference in the sort of body image concerns that men do have. And it might also be the case that men are less likely to come forward because there's more stigma attached to eating disorders in men. But the reality is that they are more prevalent, as far as we know, in women.
There we go. Getting enough nutrients to fuel your body helps to overcome emotional eating.
I'm going to sit on the fence with this one. I told you I was going to be
difficult. No, go for it. We had someone say faction, so they mixed fact and fiction together very, very cleverly.
This is it's a great question. Ask me in 10 years' time. Yeah. I think there's been a lot of interest in the link between nutrition and mental health.
Mindfulness helps ease emotional eating.
It can do. Fact.
Ooh, excellent. There we go, guys. Mindful eating, please, and mindful life. That's the way we want to be. Emotional eating is unhealthy.
It's gonna mean different things to different people.
Exactly.
We all engage in emotional eating to some degree. I doubt there's anyone listening that hasn't had a rubbish day and they've thought, you know what? Everything has just gone wrong and let me just treat myself to, and then you can fill in the gap, an ice cream, a chocolate, a pack of crisps.
Yeah.
So we all have emotions. We all require nutrition. There are going to be times when we emotionally eat. What we're really trying to emphasize here is having things in balance and not getting to a point where eating becomes a preoccupation, or that we're using our food to really regulate our emotions. That's when one is heading into the danger zone.
Yeah, no, exactly. And that's a good last question there. Lack of willpower means you're likely to be an emotional eater.
Again, to be difficult, I'm not going to answer that. I think the challenge that we have is it's too easy to point the finger. And it is always, this could be the same for anything to do with difficulties with alcohol or drugs, that it's purely down to willpower.
Yeah.
Truth is, we don't know. And I gave the example of issues people can have with their hormones, which are not their fault at all. So that's far too simple a response. And there can be a number of complex issues that people are struggling with that lead to challenging relationships with food. So we've got to be really careful not to judge people. Even if we think we might be right, it doesn't really help that person. And it's just not a very nice way to treat people.
I could not agree more. Well, Chichi, that was a wonderful fact or fiction round. It was so informative. And that does nearly wrap up the episode, which is so sad because it's such a big topic. I think it deserves a whole series in itself, to be honest. But we do finish every episode on the Food for Thought podcast with a take-home message, a food for thought. And I would like to start by just saying, as we've discussed throughout this entire conversation, it's so difficult to put a one-size-fits-all approach on life. It's just impossible. Emotions come in all different forms and shapes, and everybody comes in a different sphere of living and mindset and way of life. And we can't judge. We need to be kind. I think what's really come out from our conversation today is the need to not judge and be kind, because it's not helping. It's not getting us anywhere. And as our fact and fiction round just proved, like you mentioned with willpower, it's not that simple. And people are very quick to point the finger. And instead of helping one another in society, that's something that I think we could all do a bit more. But if you could leave, because you're our expert here today, if you could leave our listeners with something useful or a take-home message today, Chichi, what would that be?
You've totally stolen my thunder.
Oh, no.
Everything I was going to say, you pretty much said. I would just want to encourage anyone who has had a difficult relationship with food. That doesn't have to define you. I think it's really important to reach out to support. And that doesn't necessarily have to be professional support. It might just be that you need to speak to a trusted friend. There are support networks, so do use online resources if you're not able to, or you don't feel you have the confidence to speak to your GP or a psychologist or psychiatrist. But don't be discouraged, and just try and identify things that you can do. We always tend to focus on the things that are out of our control. And I think it just means that it feels like there's this insurmountable barrier. But take baby steps and think about the first things that you can do, that you can commit to, and that just gets you on that path. And then with a bit of support, things can progress.
Oh, that was lovely. I hope it's inspired everybody listening, and also to know they're not alone. Chichi, thank you so much for, I know I've wanted to get you on the podcast actually for a very long time. And as we both have babies and busy jobs and lives, I'm so glad we made it happen. Is there any resource that you would direct people to if they wanted to get in touch with you and maybe come and see you? Is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, absolutely. My website, if I can just remember it, is drchiclinic.com. I'm also the clinical lead at a new psychotherapy service, the SOAK. So that's the SOAK.uk, and more than happy to help.
Perfect. Thank you so much for coming on Food for Thought.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the final episode in series 9 of Food for Thought. Where has the time gone? I truly hope that you've learned how our bodies really are as unique as our personalities, and that we've given you the confidence to enjoy life to the fullest by following evidence-based advice. I'd like to share a huge thank you to all of my listeners and the wonderful guests that we have on. I couldn't do this without you. And if you all have the time, please do leave us a review. That way we can reach those higher highs in the charts and hopefully reach and help more and more people. For more information about my Retrition Clinic, the books, healthy recipes, and so much more, please visit Retrition.com and follow me at Retrition on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.